Morning, church. If you have your bulletin around, pull out the worksheet and we'll get busy. This is the last week of Living the Abundant Life sermon series, where we've talked about a variety of ways in which we can experience the abundant life. Have the abundant life by putting yourself first so that you can choose to be last and so on. And if you've been here through the whole series or if you followed it online, then you might, if you were careful, be able to discern there's a pattern here. Jesus, in his words, gave us five objects of love. He told us to love your neighbor as yourself. So the first week we talked about loving yourself. And then we talked about loving God. Then we talked about loving your neighbor, then loving one another, and now we get to the fun one, how to love your enemies. I mean, we've all been just on edge waiting for this one, haven't we? Let's be clear that, you know, of all the scriptures that we have, loving our enemies is probably the one that's like, oh, yeah, okay, I guess that means that if they've fallen into the ditch, I'll pull them out, but I will have nothing to do with them. So I thought I would talk about, how do you deal with the enemies that perhaps you don't have a choice about dealing with? Because in life, you're going to run into people that have become obstacles or that are obstacles to your own success or to your own heart, your own progress, your own peace of mind. What do we do with them? And I want to start by sharing with you, when I was in seminary, I was fast-tracked. I ended up in the honors program, such as it was, which means I got to choose whatever class I wanted to take, and I could focus on a particular area of expertise, and I really chose to focus on church planting, church starting, multiplication, and whatnot. But the class that I wanted to take, because I was in my second year, which meant you were sort of a lower class person compared to those who were seniors, there was a class I really wanted to take. It fit my time schedule. It was on pastoral care in crisis. I thought this would be a great class to take. And we got to the class the first day, and the professor said, there's too many of you. I can't deal with it. If you are a middler, that's what I was, you may leave now. You're disinvited from this class. Go find some other course to take. Well, thank you very much, but this is the only course in this time slot that I really wanted to take. So I took myself down to the registrar's office. And there were like one or two classes left, and really only one that fit the time slot, and that was an intensive study on the Psalms. Now, I have to tell you, my heart sank because, at least back then, I couldn't stand the Psalms. You know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and all these wonderful, saccharine, sweet things. Oh, yuck, I just don't want to get there. I want to get out and do the work and whatnot, but I didn't have a choice. I had to take this course on the Psalms. I was not a happy camper. I will tell you that no other class probably touched me as much as that class did. Because I learned something about the Psalms that a lot of people don't know. Well, first, you probably do know that the Psalms were the hymn books of Jesus' day and all of the early church, as well as the Israelites. That was their hymn book. There's five hymn books in there, and it's divided up, and there's songs that they sang or prayers that they prayed in worship. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'd known that from my undergraduate years, but what I had never done is actually read very many of the Psalms and saw the different styles of the Psalms, and not just the styles, but some of the content. And I have to tell you, there's some Psalms that in the Psalms that you're never going to sing, that you don't want to read, that you want to stay away from. I want to share with you that you probably heard, if you're a child of the 70s, you may remember the rock opera Godspell. This psalm is found, or part of the psalm, is found in that rock opera. And there are hymns written about this. And so let me read the first part, the part that we're all very familiar with. This is from Psalm 137, verses 8 and 9. And actually, I'm going to start before we go. I want to read the first couple of verses first. So this psalm starts, "By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors, demanding songs of joy, they said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Now, if you're a Godspell person, you remember that song. It was a nice little song. And I've heard sermons on Psalm 137. You probably have too if you were raised in the church, because it comes on a regular rotational basis in the lectionary. It's a beautiful psalm, but we never read verses 8 and 9. So this psalm is about how they're in captivity, that the nation is in captivity in Babylon. They've been ripped away from their home. The temple has been destroyed. The walls have been torn down of Jerusalem. They have nothing to go back to. And it's a psalm of, oh, it's a psalm of lament until you get to verse 8 and 9. And then it becomes what's called a psalm of imprecation. It's a psalm of God's going to get you. Let me just read these two verses. Remember, these are in their hymn book. They're sung in worship. Verses 8 and 9. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who sees your infants and dashes them against the rocks. Ooh. That's not what we expect to find in the Bible. Happy are those who take your babies and bash their brains out against the rocks. Ooh. Really? How is that okay? How is it we sing that in church? Or they sang it in church. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. Well, it turns out there's a whole lot of those psalms in there. There's a lot of psalms of imprecation, of, hey, God, we have a problem, you deal with it, and this is what we'd like you to do. And they're all about our enemies, or their enemies at the time. Now, the justification or the understanding of the psalms is that all of the psalms are not about what I'm going to do. They're not threats. They're saying, God, it was up to us. This is what we want you to do. But they understand that God is a God of grace and mercy, who, as we heard earlier, brings rain on the just and the unjust. And that just because we're angry enough to wish those things doesn't mean that God's going to do them and relieving it, or they relieving it, in God's hands. God, it's your problem, not mine. Boy, I tell you what, if I was you, this is what I'd do. But it's up to you. I trust you. It became a cathartic kind of thing. Love your enemies. Wow. And like I said, it turns out I enjoyed the Psalms because the Psalms cover the full range of every human emotion, from desperation and loss to great joy and salvation and everything in between. And it's like, oh, I didn't know that the Psalms were that practical, that they really do speak to everything, not just saccharine sweet. Jump into the New Testament. Things seem to be different. We'll talk about that in a moment. But, you know, it all turns to love in the New Testament, right? Love God, love neighbor, love one another, love yourself, and love your enemy. Not necessarily in that order. But, and there's some real buts there, Jesus made a presumption. Because if Jesus was anything, Jesus was a practical person. And let me tell you that Christianity is a practical religion. It's sometimes talked about as if it's, you know, woo-woo. You know, woo-woo religions. You know, it's all about love and joy and peace and everything's going to be okay. And we're all a bunch of Pollyanna idiots who think that life is wonderful. Life isn't wonderful. Some of you here are in pain at the moment. Some of you have loved ones in pain in the hospital. You have some who have mental illness. Some of you don't have enough money. Some of you are facing all sorts of trials, temptations, job problems, or enemies. And the Bible, and in particular, if you will, Jesus, was very practical and said, hey, I've got a way to help you understand and have an abundant life. So we read this, or part of this, a little bit ago, Matthew 5:43-45. You've heard it said, love your neighbors and hate your enemies. That's very Old Testament. But I tell you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Love your enemies. Pray for them. Now, that moves into the woo-woo. Oh, I just love my enemies. Jesus is presuming you have enemies. Do you hear that? Jesus presumed you'd have enemies. Jesus presumed you'd have people who would do everything they could to get in the way of you accomplishing whatever purpose God's given you. You have people who will get in the way at work or have gotten in the way with what you're trying to accomplish at work, who will try to steal your joy, who will do everything they can to undermine you and your mission. Jesus presumed you'd have them. Now, that's practical. You don't get any more practical than that. There's no idealistic world out there. Jesus says, listen, it is not going to be okay. Jesus is the one who said, they persecuted me. They're going to get you. Repeatedly, Jesus is exceptionally practical in life. And he presumed you'd have an enemy, or two, or three. So, for the remaining portion of this conversation, I want to talk about the practicalities of what we read in Scripture about how to handle our enemies. Because you have them. You know, we see the crime shows all the time. Did anyone have, the murder suspect, the murder's over here, they're interviewing everyone at the office. Who had it out for this person? Oh, no, everyone loved him. Always. You know, you never hear, oh, he was a jerk. You know, everyone would want to have, occasionally you get that, but mostly it's, oh, everyone loved him, he was so nice, and you know someone's lying because someone killed this person. And it's like, yeah, no, we all have enemies. Whether we want to be Pollyanna about it or not, you have people who are getting in the way. So what are we supposed to do with that? I want to read a little portion of Titus. Titus is a letter, Titus was a pastor, and Paul, who started churches all over the Middle East, he wrote letters to the churches he started, and the books of Timothy and Titus were actually written not to the churches, but to the pastors, to the leaders of those churches. Titus was the pastor of a church, and Paul sends him a letter, and apparently the church was having a little bit of conflict going on, and so he tells him how to handle it. So Titus 3, 1 to 2, and 9 to 12, or whatever it was, it's on your bulletin, he writes, remind the people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever is good, to slander no one, to be peaceable and considerate, and always to be gentle towards everyone. That first part there starts off with be good to folks, including the authorities, and he's not writing to Titus and say, hey, tell them to be nice to you. He's writing to Titus and say, tell them that they've got the police out there, they got the soldiers out there, they got the temple people out there, they've got the Jewish people out there, they got people who are in charge, whoever they are, the people in authorities, the Roman government, even though they're an oppressive organization, do all these things. Be good to them, be kind to them, keep the peace. He goes on, though. Now, he gets back and brings it closer. What do we do in the church? Because, Titus, you're having problems in your church. So he says, avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and arguments and quarrels about the law, about policies, about the way things are supposed to be, because these are unprofitable and useless. Warn a divisive person once, then warn them a second time. After that, have nothing to do with them. You may be sure that such people are warped and sinful. They are self-condemned. Now, that sounds pretty harsh. Paul, where do you get that kind of conversation? How do you get there with all that? How do you get to that place? Well, for all practical purposes, no, not for all practical purposes, Paul is quoting Jesus. from Matthew 18. In Matthew 18, 15 to 17, he says, listen, if you've got someone who has sinned, someone who's creating problems, you know, you go to them one-on-one. And if that doesn't work, you go to them two or three-on-one. And if that doesn't work, you take it to the church, you put them out of the fellowship, you treat them as, essentially it says to shun them, to just put it into our language today. You just shun them. You don't let them come back. You ignore them. You have nothing to do with them. Jesus said, don't even eat with them. But before you get to that point, he says, and this is number two, in as much as possible, don't set out to make more enemies. You know, if you don't make more enemies, and you're going to have enemies, Jesus said, you're going to have enemies, but don't make more. Don't go out there with the intentions of just, you know, poking people's buttons. Don't be a jerk. Be kind. Be grace-filled. Let your conversation be filled with good things. Be obedient. Do what the law requires. And then he says, and don't get into silly arguments. Because the reality is about those silly arguments, and we do in the church. I know none of you look on Facebook. No, never see any bad behavior on Facebook. But I can't tell you how many times I'm flipping through and I see some Christian that writes something that's really controversial about Scripture or about a church or about a pastor, and all of a sudden there's this huge pile-on, and people are just being ugly to each other and about each other and tearing down the church or tearing down the Bible verse or the interpretation of that Bible verse. And, of course, the rest of the world looking go, yep, that's what I thought Christians were like. Yep, bunch of contentious people. I want nothing to do with it. We shoot ourselves in the head. We make public proclamations that are just like, really? So don't make more enemies. Don't engage in these kinds of behaviors of silly arguments. And in fact, don't argue about theologies. That's the law and all that. Because the reality is most theologies, some we're pretty black and white on. But most of the things we argue about, theological, you can't prove one way or the other. Biggest controversy right now in the American church is what's called Reformed theology and non-Reformed theology. Reformed theology is like the Presbyterian theology where you have the elect. Jesus died for the elect. He didn't die for the whole world, because that would put you in double jeopardy. And he dies for you and you and you, but you're out, and you're out, and et cetera. Predestination, you probably heard that. There's a huge pushback on that right now in our nation. The problem is that I can prove that that's absolutely the way it is in the Bible. But I can also prove in the same Bible that it's whoever will, that whosoever believeth in him. And there's not, you're in, you're out, you're in. It's all up to you. I can prove both sides. And so why are we arguing? Because you can't prove either one right. And you can't prove either one wrong. So get over it, move on. And life's that way with a lot of the things in which we disagree with. You can't really prove your point. You think you can, but not so much. And we push back and forth. So don't go out and make more enemies. Like, duh. But the Bible gives us New Testament gives us four biblical approaches to dealing with your enemies. Four practical things to do. First, A, if you will, convert them. Convert them, because some will become your allies. When I say convert them, I don't mean, you know, if you died tonight, you know for sure you go to heaven. I'm talking about these are your enemies. I'm talking about turn them into your friends. Get to know their story. Find out who they are. Find out what makes them tick. Help them become an ally. Now, you can't do that with all your enemies. All your enemies aren't going to do that. You got some people who just want nothing to do with it. But that was what Abraham Lincoln did when the South fell. He did everything he could to unify the nation. He tried to get the nations, the people of the nations, to forgive each other, families to forgive each other, to move on, to help them become allies. It's what we did in World War II in Japan. We invested billions to rebuild Japan, trying to make and, you know, help them become our allies. By the way, it worked in Japan. We're still fighting the Civil War in America, but in some places. But you convert them. Help them become on your side. Listen to what they have to say. Hopefully they'll listen to what you have to say. Hopefully you'll find places you can agree and places where you could agree to disagree agreeably. The problem is when we agree to disagree disagreeably. That's the problem. And we have a lot of that going around in our culture right now. We disagree and we're just disagreeable about it. Number one, convert them, some will become your allies. Jesus did this. Do you notice who Jesus hung out with? I mean, he hung out with the crowds, but if you look at every party he went to go hang out with a Sadducee or a Pharisee. These are people who were his enemies. They couldn't stand him. They were doing everything they could to get him locked up, to get him killed, to get him out of the way. Jesus spent time trying to build a relationship, and it worked with Nicodemus. Nicodemus was both a Pharisee and a Sadducee, a rare breed. Nicodemus, and you may remember that's the whole passage in John 3:16, you know, whosoever believeth in me, you know, shall not perish. That's a conversation that Jesus had with Nicodemus. Nicodemus spent time with Jesus, and Jesus spent time with Nicodemus. And Nicodemus became a Christian. He became an ally of Jesus. So first line of response is to convert them. Try and help them get on board with you or where you're going. And if it's at work and you have a particular direction you're trying to go, take the company or do something in your job, help them to get on board with what you're doing, particularly if you don't have a choice and that's what you have to do. But the problem is not everyone's going to get on board. And so the number two is sometimes you just have to neutralize them. And when you neutralize your enemies, they become irrelevant. Now, what we mean by that is to sideline them. When you neutralize your enemy, it removes their power, at least from your sphere of influence. Jesus does that on a pretty regular basis as well. He either walks away from people or he just sidelines them. He avoids them. He ignores them. He helps get them into positions in which they can't do more damage. If you neutralize your enemy, if you get them sidelined, get them cornered, get them moved out of the division or moved out of your division or get them anywhere but where you are and where your influence is, do everything you can to remove their power. Sometimes that's just by taking away their voice, not putting them in a place of a position of leadership. Making sure they're not in positions of leadership. You neutralize them, and if they can't do any damage to you or your organization, then they become irrelevant. They can do whatever, and it's okay. Number three, eliminate them. Now, to be fair, years and years and years ago, I read in a book by a friend of mine who used these three, and he said to convert them, neutralize them, or kill them. I thought, okay, that's not really, and of course he doesn't actually mean kill them, but eliminate them, get them off the playing field. That's really what Paul is telling Titus to do. You warn the dissentious person once, you warn him twice, and then you have nothing to do with them. And what he's saying, this is to a pastor, he says, you remove them from the church, you remove them from your organization. So if you're in business, if you have an enemy, someone on your staff who is undermining you, don't wait till next week to remove them from your staff. They'll just do increasingly more and more damage. Jesus did this with Judas. Go and do what you got to do. Now, there was a bigger plan in play here. But Jesus regularly eliminated and avoided those who were contentious. In fact, on a couple of occasions, he was invited to go back to Galilee, and he would not go because of the king that was up there, King Philip, who was one of the Caesars, who was out to get Jesus. He said, no, I'll just stay away from there. Now, he couldn't do the eliminating. He eliminated himself from the situation. Sometimes you have to remove yourself. Sometimes you have to remove the thorn. Sometimes you have to say, we're going to miss you. And away they go. Again, Matthew 18, 15 to 17, very clear about that. Someone in the church sins, go to them one-on-one, two-on-one, remove them. Remove them from the church. It's practical advice in real life. It's what we have to do sometimes with our enemies. We have to eliminate them. If we can, if we have the power to fire them, if you're the business owner, then that's what you have to do. If you have a staff member or whatever. The other thing is, what about your family? I know that everyone here has a perfectly functional, loving family, that you don't have any black sheep in your family. You don't have anyone who's ever abused someone else physically or emotionally or spiritually. I know you don't have any of those people in your lives, but you've heard of people like that. Sometimes you have to eliminate them. Sometimes, I'm going to catch heck for this, not every marriage is made in heaven. Sometimes marriages have to end. Sometimes you have to practice tough love with a family member. Sometimes you have a child who's been hanging on and creating issues or not living the life and bringing everyone else down, including you and your family, hurting the family. Sometimes you got to say, I'm setting boundaries. We're done. You may not come home. Man, that's hard. But sometimes that's what's called for. D. Sometimes you have to incubate them, and they'll grow your faith. What I mean by that is sometimes your enemies aren't going away, and you have no control over it. Sometimes you're going to be co-workers with an enemy, and you have no way of converting them. They're not going to convert. They can't stand you, don't like you, whatever. My wife and I, we're the Tenny Britons, and people ask us about the Tenny Britons, and we say, you know, the Tenny Britons are the Tenny Britons. People either love us or they hate us, and there's very few in between. People that really like the things we say because we're very adamant about what it takes to do the work that we do. And some people love that and what we say. Other people just cannot stand to be in our presence. We get that. There's not very many people here in the middle. Tenny Britons, yeah, they're okay. That's okay. I mean, we're both in strong leadership positions. And sometimes, though, we can't do the converting them. Sometimes we can't neutralize them. Sometimes we can't eliminate. Sometimes we're stuck with all, and you're stuck. And that's when you call on God to incubate that relationship, to use that relationship to grow your faith, to help you become a more loving, tolerant kind of person, which is not exactly fun. We don't want to become that kind of a person. Can't just, Lord, I want patience now. Paul writes several times that, you know, these difficult times build in us perseverance, and perseverance builds in us, you know, tolerance and faith, and it helps us become better people. Sometimes our faith is being incubated by the people around us that are difficult. And when they are that way, it's really hard to really consider them enemies, given the fact of what they're doing in your life in helping you become the person of faith who lives a life. On your tear off, if you will, take it out, your bulletin. Tear it off. Oh, I hear lots of tearing. That's good. Yeah, that's good, good. On the communication side, if you're a first-time visitor, fill that out and drop it in one of the baskets as you leave the congregation, leave the center. We give $5 to the Harvester's Food Pantry to help feed people here in Raytown. If you'll fill that out, mark that you're a first-time visitor, and drop it. You participate in that ministry. On the count me in side, I'll be here next Sunday. Next Sunday, we start a new sermon series, a new conversation series on, what are we talking about next week? We're talking about time, that what you do today impacts your tomorrow, that every decision you make today impacts your tomorrow. We're going to look at investing in your future, so I hope that you'll be a part of that. And of course, we hope you invite a friend. And then there's four. There's not only four, there's normally three. But these are the steps of dealing with your enemies. And so just real quick, number one, I'll be proactive. If you're not proactive with your enemies, they'll just continue to haunt you. Decide you need to do something. Jesus didn't just avoid his enemies. He either confronted them, he eliminated them, he ignored them, he tried to convert them. Decide you're going to do something about those who are getting in your way, those obstacles. Number two, I'll identify my enemies. Sometimes we're not even aware of people who are trying to undermine us. Go ahead. I know it's not comfortable stuff, but who's your enemy? Who are those people who are getting in the way of your life, of your success, your personal success, your spiritual success? Just flat out identify them. And then begin praying for them. Do you know almost every single time we read Jesus in the New Testament and Paul, it always, dealing with your enemies always starts with prayer. Pray for them. Now, you can pray Psalm 137, 8, 9 if you want to. I don't recommend it. But, you know, as long as you're leaving it to God. But, you know, maybe pray that they'd be blessed. What a novel thought. In fact, in Romans, Paul quotes a proverb that says, pray, if your enemy is hungry, feed them. Thereby, you're putting heaping coals upon their head. All right, not wild about the imagery or the motivation, but pray for your enemies. Do good to your enemies. That's what Jesus had to say, is what Paul had to say. Pray for them. So identify them, pray for them, and then determine the best course of action for dealing with your enemies. Look at that list and say, can I convert them? How do I build a relationship with them? What do I need to do? Do I need to have a one-on-one heart-to-heart? Do I maybe just need to smile more and be civil? How do I make that first step in turning my adversary into an ally? Then if that's not possible, or as you look and say, yeah, that's not going to happen, how do you neutralize them? How do you neutralize their power in your life? And if you can't, is it possible to eliminate them? Can you avoid them completely? Again, if you're in a business, can you remove them? Give them their pink slip. It'll be good for your business if you have people who are trying to undermine your business. And then finally, if that's not possible, how are you going to use it to incubate this relationship? How can you, as you pray and as you work with this person side by side, whether you can remove them or not, how do you incubate that relationship so that your faith grows? So I invite you to check those as between you and God. It's also on your handout. You can check there to remind yourself what you're going to do. Will you pray with me? Lord, not everything's pleasant. Sometimes we got to deal with what is. Give us the courage to face the what is with your grace, to face that with your love, to remember that you've called us to love everyone on this planet, and that sometimes giving that love means being away from each other. And that's the most loving thing we can do. Give us the courage to see your word and be able to apply it. In Jesus' name, amen.